Although our family name is fine, the original one was something Polish. It changed on Ellis Island as Pop came through the glass walkway and into that great receiving room of America. His first name was Solomon, but everyone called him Sol or Solly. He rented a factory where he designed, cut, and stitched petticoats. It was located on the east side of Newark, known as the Ironbound section. Italian immigrants lived there mostly. Upstairs from Pop's factory was the Lewis Cigar Company, where they made John Ruskin and Flor de Melba cigars. Before petticoats, Pop made handkerchiefs, which sold for 10 cents apiece. But he quickly discovered that with the same sewing machines, he could produce petticoats cut from taffeta and silk and make lots more money. At least, until his health and sales began falling off. He learned the sewing trade in the old country and had practiced it in West Virginia, where he first settled after landing in New York. A cousin of his wrote him about the beauties of West Virginia and mailed him a ticket to Charleston. A year later, he sent for his fiancée, Celia, who'd been patiently waiting in Poland. Charleston, according to Pop, was friendly and had a slow elegance about it. Lovely homes with great porches and swings and beautiful young women swinging in front of their houses, their long hair blowing in the breeze. It was a rich community, but Pop couldn't figure out the source of the money. Except for the colored people, it seemed like nobody worked. Everybody dressed for dinner. Negro maids served from silver tea sets. Pop was sure Celia would love it. But when she arrived, she looked around and told Pop that it had taken thousands of years for the Jews to escape from the desert, and she had no intention of returning. He tried to reason with her, but she said that a city with no more than a dozen Jewish families was no city at all. So they made their way from Charleston to Newark, New Jersey, which most people regard not as a desert, but as a joke. I liked it, except for school. Pop was a big man, 6 feet 2 inches tall, and before he got sick, 220 pounds. Quite a dresser he was. On Sundays, when he and Celia would stroll through Weequahic Park, he wore a Prince Albert coat, spats, striped pants, a silk shirt with cufflinks, a collar fastened with a button, a silk tie with a diamond stickpin, a dress handkerchief showing in his chest pocket, Oxford shoes bought at Coward's, and a derby. He carried a gold-headed cane and was never without a cigarette in his mouth. A heavy smoker, he said, there were only 3 brands worth smoking. Turkish Trophies, which came in a flat reddish box, Camels, and Lord Salisbury cigarettes. At home, his clothes were meticulously hung and placed in a chiffarobe, and his shoes polished with wax and stored in wooden trees that looked like carved pieces of art. Celia dressed less fashionably. Although she lacked Saul's confidence and always felt like a greenhorn, she didn't want to compete with him. To dress like Saul, you really had to think you were hot stuff. Her lack of fluency in one language undoubtedly held her back. She spoke Polish, German, Russian, Yiddish, and English, but none of them with facility. Her schlepping around so much as a kid caused her to rely on Yiddish, the one constant speech among the Jews whom she met. But even her Yiddish rang with words from other tongues. Born in Russia, she was only 3 or 4 when her parents, who were in the needle trade, and frequently in search of work, began moving all over Europe. Romania, Pomerania, Armenia, Lithuania, and maybe some other Anias as well, eventually settling in Poland. She never heard one language long enough to master it. The experts call her kind of speech a polyglot. I call it a stew. Pop was a different story. He had a way with English. Sol and Celia had met in Poland. At 18, she arrived in West Virginia. In Newark, where I was born 5 years later, the family spoke mostly Yiddish. I translated for my mom. At the grocery store, the butcher, the bank, the shoemaker, the department store, everywhere but at school. Mom wouldn't go near the place. Embarrassed by her lack of language and formal education, she regarded teachers as gods, accessible only to high priests and children. I tried to tell her that teachers were just like everyone else, but she merely frowned and said emphatically, "A teacher's a teacher." Sometimes in the morning, I'd stand in front of the long mirror Pop had hung on my door and think, maybe if I wasn't a tomboy and wasn't so small, the other kids called me a runt, I'd do better in school. And maybe if my name wasn't Henrietta, a name honoring an Uncle Harry in Russia who died during a pogrom, kids wouldn't laugh and call me Hen the Chicken Scratcher. And maybe, too, if my hair wasn't black and curly, but blonde and straight, like so many of the Gentile girls, and if my nose was just a tad smaller and turned up at the end, and if I had fewer freckles, I might fit in a lot better. But eventually I gave up on fitting in and decided that even if people were like pennies and looked just alike, some person would say his penny was better because it was older or newer. Troublemakers are always looking for differences. Pop used to say that America was the only European country on earth, that France was a country of Frenchmen and Germany full of Germans, and you'd better believe it. The mixing of people in America, he said, was like Russian dressing. Mayonnaise and ketchup by themselves are all right, but when you mix them, you get a really good taste. His factory, before he fell ill and had to let everyone go, was like Russian dressing. The cutters and sewing machine operators and shipping clerks and salesmen all proudly called themselves Mr. Fine's Help. They were robustly Americans, even though they spoke almost a dozen different languages. Italian, German, Yiddish, Greek, Russian, Polish, French, Spanish, Romanian, Serbo-Croatian, and even Ladino. The Negro floor lady, Susie Somerset, spoke the best English of all. She had moved from Harlem to Newark and could outwork any three men in the factory. She was like a second mother to me. When Celia had scarlet fever and diphtheria and Pop stayed home to measure her medicines and give her bonkus, that's when you apply hot cups to someone's back to draw out the fever, I was sent to live with Susie. Pop was afraid I might catch the germs. One night, returning from Throm's drugstore, where I went for a chocolate malt, I ran into a couple of jerks who began teasing me outside of Susie's house. I told them to scram, but they wouldn't leave me alone. Susie saw it all from the front window. In a flash, she stood on the front steps of the house with a pail of hot water, which she threw at the sparks. Boy, did they hot-foot it out of there! Now, with Pop hospitalized and Mum at his bedside, Susie was living at our house taking care of me. The two of us mostly played Chinese checkers. The Sunday before Pop died, I was winning for once. That's when Mum called to say that Pop wanted me to close the deals with his competitors. The next morning, when Susie and I arrived at the factory, the front door was unlocked. We glanced at each other, alarmed. I cautiously opened the door. A minute later, I felt like Lot turned into a pillar of salt for having looked at a forbidden scene. In front of us, occupying the great expanse of the factory floor, was nothing. Nothing. The place had been cleaned out. The only other person with keys to the factory was my Uncle Sam, a jealous younger brother Pop had taken in because he could never support himself. It was Sam, that gold-bricking bum, though he had a nice wife, who was in charge of the factory during Pop's illness. As I learned from the cigar man upstairs, Sam had driven a truck up to the factory and removed everything, the the sewing machines, the patterns, the cutting tables and tools, the hundreds of bolts of taffeta and silk, the office equipment, even the three-way light sockets, and refused to say where he was headed. I kept the news of the theft from Mom until the funeral was over and we had reached the street. When I told her that Uncle Sam had cleaned out the factory and that I wanted to go to the cops to report him, she grabbed my arm and emphatically said, "If he was arrested and put in jail, what then? Is that what you want for your Aunt Anna, to humiliate her? It would be a shanda, a black mark on the family name. I won't allow it." For a moment, I knew what Pop must have felt when Mom said she wouldn't stay in West Virginia. Although only 5 feet tall and the sweetest, most agreeable woman in the world, Mom had a mind of her own when it came to the family name and reputation. I could see that if I went to the cops, I'd feel guilty the rest of my life. People make jokes about Jewish guilt. This much I know. When parents are unkind, we shouldn't be surprised that their children behave badly. But when parents are a mitzvah, a blessing, the kids feel guilty if they don't do what they should. I still had 2 months of school left before summer vacation, so I tried to catch up, having fallen behind owing to Pop's illness and death. But there was still the problem of my handwriting. I was left-handed, and in Latin, the word for left hand means sinister. So teachers assumed that left-handed people were bad. Surely not every lefty in Rome was a thief or a murderer. Anyway, my teachers tied my left hand behind my back and made me write with my right hand so I wouldn't grow up to be sinister. You can imagine what my handwriting looked like. Chicken scratching. The teachers would hold up my papers for the class to see and make nasty remarks about my penmanship. I never said anything, since it wouldn't have done any good. But you can be sure it did not make me glad to be returning to school.